employees had earned. The reward for their furious innovation, imagination, and experimentation. Their efforts had precipitated a blizzard of success, requiring Sega to move into a new building in late 1991. It was a long, gray, two-story building in Redwood City, with the downstairs dedicated to operations, sales, market research, and human resources, and the upstairs devoted to marketing, legal, and the executive staff. The Redwood City office was a bit more formal than the last one, but still had a humble work-in-progress feel that precluded any sort of Jefferson's-like moving-on-up moment. Besides, with things just beginning to heat up, everyone was too busy to spend time patting each other on the back. Sega went into Christmas 1991 by continuing to curve upward at a near-exponential rate, and by now had captured about 25% of the market. Stores were selling out of the Genesis with such frequency that it began to become a problem. It was great to feel like the popular, unattainable guy at the party, but not at the risk of suitors settling for a more available, second-rate friend. At first, Sega managed the problem by air freighting in systems from Japan, a costly proposition, but worth the additional overhead to avoid losing customers. But, like a Band-Aid that's lost its sticking power, this was no longer a viable option as the holidays approached and demand skyrocketed. To maintain the momentum, Nilsson spearheaded a marketing program intended to prevent parents from settling for Nintendo at any cost. The initial concept was for a pre-order reservation kit that would ensure customers a Genesis by a certain date and reward them for waiting with a free collectible t-shirt. But with the crazy Christmas season around the bend, it was impossible to get retailers set up in time. So Nilsson took the idea and stuck it in his pocket for a rainy day, at the time not realizing how well it would serve Sega in the future. Instead, with the same c'est la vie spirit that Kalinske and Nilsson had taken 1 year earlier with the Buster Douglas game, Sega decided to embrace the dilemma. Starting on December 9th, Sega launched their Worth Waiting For campaign. They aired ads on national television and radio, print would have taken too long, to speak directly to customers and let them know that even though the Genesis was red hot and might be hard to find, they shouldn't give in and buy an SNES. Sega revealed that they were air freighting in new systems every day and suggested that customers keep checking with their local stores, turning a frustrating shortage into something of a rousing scavenger hunt. The ads also publicized a toll-free number that allowed callers to voice their grievances and, at the same time, receive a special offer to buy one of four titles directly from Sega with guaranteed arrival before Christmas. As a result, Sega managed to dominate the holiday season and edge out their hated rival. Or did they? Kalinske stared out the window of his new office, positively convinced that Sega had stolen Christmas from Nintendo. 800 miles north, however, it was fair to assume that Peter Main was drinking a cup of coffee and reveling in Nintendo's destruction of Sega. Nintendo claimed to have its goal of 2.1 million Super Nintendos sold by the end of 1991. The problem was, however, that even though Nintendo had sold all these systems to retailers, those retailers had only sold about 70% of the product, meaning that on the day after Christmas, stores still had 30% of their Nintendo inventory on the shelves, which they could return, mark down, or continue to sell. Sega, on the other hand, sold through a staggering 95% of their systems, totaling 1.6 million by the end of the year. Though numbers can get slippery, Sega's 1.6 million was higher than Nintendo's 1.4 million, 70% of 2.1 million, making them the clear victor. Then again, Nintendo had only been selling the SNES in September, just a third of the entire year, further devolving the issue into a heated cup of number soup. "True or false?" Steve Race asked, sidling into Kalinske's office. "The real reason we moved from South San Francisco to Redwood City was because Nakayama believed the wind here would be kinder to his comb-over." "I can neither confirm nor deny that," Kalinske said, as Race took a seat in front of his desk. "But if I had to lean one way or the other, it would not be toward deny." "Perfect," Race said. "I've always believed that there is an illustrious career waiting for me in the conspiracy theory racket."
"Oh yeah?"
Kalinske asked.
"Well, there's an illustrious career waiting for you here at Sega if you're ready to make the move to full-time."
"Jumping right into the ball pit, are you?" Race mused.
How dare you deprive me of that patented Kalinske small talk? For example, how was your Christmas? You want small talk? Kalinske playfully replied. All right, here you go. During the break, Karen comes up to me with this sneaky look on her face. It's a classic of hers, one of my favorites, and she tells me that she has news. Which do I want first, the good news or the bad? Of course, I want the good, so that's what I say, and back comes that sneaky look, and she says, it's a boy. Congrats, Race exclaimed. That's a hell of a gift. Sure is, Kalinske replied. And what about you? How was your Christmas? There may have been some seasonal debauchery, Race murmured, but nothing too crazy. In fact, for the most part, it was a very Sega-filled holiday season. I started really digging into the handheld market. Is your disciple not working out? Rather the opposite. Thus far, Diane has been a godsend, Race said, referring to Diane Adair. Race had hired her in late November to replace Bob Botch, Sega's director of marketing responsible for the Game Gear, who left to become president of a software company called U.S. Gold. Though Race was admittedly not broken-hearted to see Botch go, as he had grown tired of breaking up shouting matches between Botch and Nilsson, the timing couldn't have been worse. With Sega growing at sonic speed, Botch's departure threatened to throw a wrench into things. Luckily, Adair fit right in and hit the ground running. She was a doe-eyed woman with a happy-go-lucky voice, and she wasn't afraid to dive headfirst into problems or get her hands dirty. With Nintendo now in the 16-bit console business, Sega's executive staff wanted to extend the lines of battle and make their opponent fight a war on two fronts, hence the emphasis on the handheld Game Gear. At this point, the Game Gear had been in stores for over 6 months, and sales were strong but not spectacular. Part of the reason was continued problems with battery life, but a larger part was the lack of software, visibility, and brand identity. Kalinske hoped that Adair could pull a rabbit from her hat and do for the Game Gear what Nilsson was doing for the Genesis. Sega had been able to come up with creative solutions to some of the challenges. For example, an accessory could be purchased to extend battery life, and found imaginative ways to take advantage of the Game Gear's un-Nintendo-like ability to display colors. A tuner could be purchased that allowed one to watch TV on the handheld. During her second week on the job, Adair became fast friends with Race's other key hire, EBVB. Both women had been sent to Los Angeles for media training sessions with their PR guru Brenda Lynch at MSNL. There, Adair was wowed by EBVB's on-camera presence and her talent for compressing complicated topics into easily digestible media bites. EBVB, equally smitten, perceived Adair as a model of efficiency, always planning 10 steps ahead with another 5 steps in reserve as a backup in case things went awry. Mutual admiration quickly led to daily morning jogs, which ultimately led to long-lasting friendship. She's a playmaker, Race said, who had known Adair since the late 80s, when she had worked for him at a failed startup called Homestar that sold housewares by phone. She's just as good in the worst of times as she is in the best of times. That's rare, trust me. She'll be a big part of what you're putting together here. I don't doubt it, Kalinske said. But what about you? Right now, the $64,000 question, Ray said with a grin. There's a lot more money in it for you than 64 grand. It's not about the money. It's always a little bit about the money. Race bobbed his head. True, but obviously that's not the issue here. So what's the issue? Kalinske asked. The budgets are too low? No, Race said dismissively. You know I like doing more for less. You don't like the games? I don't like any games, Race conceded. But ours seem better than most. The marketing team? I've let you stack the deck with your own aces, all key personnel except Al, Kalinske said, considering this. Is he the problem? Nilsson? Race said with a chortle. He's a strange dude, that guy. You would think he has a hidden laboratory where he pulls the wings off butterflies. Hey, Kalinske said, defending Nilsson. If he keeps churning out these great wild ideas, then I'll buy him a case of exotic butterflies. Save the call to your butterfly broker, Race said. Nilsson is an odd duck, but he's a good guy nonetheless. And he's drunk the company Kool-Aid, which never hurts. Most people have, Kalinske noted. Myself included. And it tastes great. I'd love nothing more than to do the same, Ray said. But if you look on the label, you'll notice that it says Made in Japan right there beside the ingredients. Seriously? Kalinske asked. The Japan thing again? Trust me, Race explained. I don't give a shit about the color of someone's skin or the slant of their eyes. All I care about is doing business, and our friends in Japan seem intent on fucking us at every turn. Kalinske nodded, because he shared a lot of the same frustrations. He also wasn't completely surprised to hear this. He knew that Race had been locking horns with some of the folks at SOJ, who had taken to calling him racist in Japanese behind his back. Kalinske just hadn't realized this had mounted to the point that it was preventing Race from accepting the opportunity of a lifetime. I understand where you're coming from, Kalinske said. Believe me, I really do. Sometimes it drives me crazy. But at the end of the day, Nakayama has always been fair to me and let me run this how I want to. LPGA tour? Race asked. Fine, almost always, Kalinske said with a light-hearted roll of the eyes. But don't let that stuff drag you down. I can protect you. Can you, though? Race asked. And even if so, for how long? Do you really think that success is going to keep that at bay? I do. I really do, Kalinske said. But I realize that I'm not in a position to offer you a lifelong guarantee. What I can offer you, though, is the opportunity to lead a marketing assault unlike anything the world has ever seen before. Go on, Ray said, raising an eyebrow. A little over a year ago when I went to Japan, Nakayama gave me the green light to hire a new ad agency and go to town. I've been waiting for the right moment, and I'm thinking this would be a great way to ring in the new year. I want to get going on this right away, but before getting started, I want to make sure that you'll be here through the whole agency review process. We need a leader here. Can I count on you? Race was flattered, but didn't answer right away. I don't know, Race said, playing out various scenarios in his mind. But I think we've both been around the block enough times to realize that anything short of yes, sir, absolutely, is probably going to come back and haunt one of us down the road. You're right, Kalinske said with a sigh. Thank you for being the one to say it. Would you like to continue on in some sort of part-time consulting role? I think a clean break would be best, Race said. Though, if possible, I'd like to hang around for another few weeks. Train the new guy, show him around CES, and just generally plant seeds of dissension where I see fit. Of course, Kalinske said. And I want you to know that even though this didn't quite work out as I had hoped, you were worth the wait. Thanks, Tom, Race said. I know you have a very high opinion of me, probably inaccurately so, but I want you to know that I think the same of you. Kalinske nodded, touched. With the sappy stuff out of the way, Race leaned back in his chair, making himself at home. Now on to more important matters. You excited for CES? Are you kidding me? Kalinske asked. This will be the first time we go into a show with a sliver of respect. I can't wait. Yourself? Oh, sure, Race said. Slivers of respect are nothing to sneeze at, but for my money, I'm much more excited about successfully convincing the overlords to hire Big Bang Beat for the party. Chapter 21 The Heart and the Brain. Big Bang Beat flooded the Alexis Park Hotel's eco-friendly Parthenon Ballroom with an energetic smorgasbord of rock, soul, disco, and swing. The 12-piece party band played hits from the 60s, 70s, and 80s with such shimmering gusto that it felt like a bar mitzvah, graduation party, and wedding all rolled into one. This was Sega's opening night party at the 1992 Winter Consumer Electronics Show, and in many ways, it was all of those things. It represented an unofficial coming-of-age ceremony, a graduation to the major leagues, and an irreversible marriage into the video game industry's royal family. This was everything Kalinske had been waiting for. In an elegant sport coat and playful Sonic the Hedgehog tie, Kalinske danced under the high ceilings of the gold-paneled ballroom. He normally didn't like to get up and dance, but tonight the auditory ecstasy was contagious. It was as if the music exploded out of the band's oversized instruments, zigzagged around the crowded room and latched on to the wrists, hips, and ankles of the guests, pulling them to the dance floor. The music captured Kalinske, his employees, and even the jet-lagged representatives of SOJ. It infected members of the press, third-party developers, and Sega's corporate partners. The music even managed to seduce the retailers, an old-school breed of businessmen who rarely unleash their embarrassing array of dance moves. Van Buskirk was dancing beside Kalinske and Adair. "I take it you're enjoying your first CES?" Kalinske asked her. "Sorry," Van Buskirk said, looking around the room to see which of the dancers looked most ridiculous. "Mental photography session in progress. I wish I had a real camera with me. Oh, I can't believe how uncoordinated some of these guys are." "And you?" Kalinske asked Adair. "Considering that a couple of hours ago I thought I was fired," Adair said, "I would say that I'm having a grand old time."
"Fired? What? Why?"
To the sounds of a high-energy rendition of I Will Survive, Adair relayed the details of her afternoon. She had been in the middle of taking buyers through the upcoming titles for Game Gear at Sega's booth when someone came by with an ominous-sounding message slip for her. Nakayama was in town for the occasion and wanted her to come up to his suite immediately. After instantly going pale, she excused herself and went to Nakayama's room as instructed, believing that she was about to be canned 6 weeks into her stint at Sega. When she got to his suite, Nakayama quizzed her on a multitude of topics. Why had Nintendo been successful? Why did she want to join Sega? What were her parents like? After the lightning round ended, Nakayama nodded and congratulated her on a job well done. Before he could dismiss her, though, faint tremors from a small earthquake shook the room. Adair brushed off the jolt, but Nakayama immediately dove headfirst underneath a nearby conference table. Adair bundled together all the strength she'd gathered from her adult life, thanked Nakayama for his time, and ran back to Sega's booth, cackling all the way. Even now, 2 hours later, she couldn't help giggling at the memory. "No way," Kalinske said. "Just no way."
"Yes way," Adair said. "And if you're imagining what it looked like, the answer is yes. His comb-over did get all ruffled in the process."
"Now it's really too bad you didn't have a camera with you."
"I know."
"Where is our mutual friend?" Kalinske said, scanning the ballroom. "I haven't seen him this evening."
"Oh, God," Adair said. "You can't tell him I told you, please. I know I should have prefaced the story with that, but please don't tell him."
"Of course not. We're a team," Kalinske said.
She smiled with relief, and they went back to dancing alongside Ryo, Toyota, Schroeder, and Nilsson, whose giant public smile kept being interrupted by a sly private one whenever he thought about an incident that had occurred earlier in the day. He had been walking through Caesar's Palace with Ken Balthasar and Clyde Grossman, normal as a day at a Vegas casino can be, until someone noticed the three of them wearing Sega jackets. After it was discovered that they worked at Sega, they were instantly treated like celebrities. Someone even offered to comp their gambling if they were willing to reveal Sonic game tips while playing cards. It really was a night to remember, with nobody able to resist the silky allure of the music. Except for Nakayama. It appeared that no amount of corporate success could coerce his feet into dance steps. Yet it was clear from his shining eyes, judicious nods, and executioner's grin that he was pleased by the world around him. He celebrated the occasion at a table in the corner of the ballroom, speaking passionately with a thick-jawed man in a sharp suit from a decade long gone. This was Nakayama's friend and business partner, and Sega's original founder, David Rosen. Out of the corner of his eye, Kalinske saw Nakayama and Rosen seated together. He waved in their direction, but they did not wave back. They probably didn't notice, he told himself. But a small part of him suspected that they had snubbed him as some kind of maneuver in their series of bizarre head games. Of all the business relationships that Kalinske had seen in his time, the one between Nakayama and Rosen easily qualified as one of the strangest. There was clearly a good deal of respect between the two men, but their opposite personalities, the geographic distance between them, and decades of drama made for an unusual dynamic between the two most important figures in Sega's history, the man who had created the company and the man who had shaped it in his image. Like most tangled relationships, the one between Nakayama and Rosen began years before the two ever even met. In 1949, David Rosen, then an 18-year-old ambitious pragmatist, enlisted in the United States Air Force. His unit was sent to Asia and stationed at various bases throughout the continent before, during, and after the Korean War. When his service ended in 1954, the Brooklyn-born entrepreneur remained in Japan and formed Rosen Enterprises, whose greatest success came in the photography business. At the time, the Japanese had a strong need for ID photos to be used for anything from school applications to rice ration cards. But photographs were expensive and required a substantial amount of time, with the typical photo studio charging 250 yen and taking about 3 days. Rosen's solution was to import coin-operated photo booths from America and set these up throughout Japan. By charging less and delivering photos instantly, the fully automated booths became an instant success. From there, Rosen Enterprises began importing all kinds of coin-operated products, like jukeboxes and pinball machines. In 1965, Rosen Enterprises merged with Nihon Goraku Busan, a prominent Japanese jukebox company which, most important, had a large manufacturing facility in Tokyo that was idle. Rosen was made chairman of the new venture, which was named after the English translation of Nihon Goraku Busan, Service Games, hence Sega Enterprises. A year later, Sega created its first original product, an electromechanical submarine game. Without the luxury of digital code, computer chips, and colorful screens, electromechanical games ran on a tightly rigged system of switches, relays, motors, and lights. In the evolutionary track of interactive entertainment, they were nothing but monkey business compared to the arcade video games that would soon follow. But in 1966, Sega's electromechanical contraption was leaps and bounds ahead of the pinball machines and skee-ball games of its era. Their original creation was a bulky red and gray machine that stretched to 10 feet long and 6 feet wide, highlighted by an actual periscope in front. The game consisted of players peering into the viewfinder and swiveling a torpedo-shaped light to aim at enemy ships. Successful assaults were rewarded with flashing red lights and a gurgled explosion, while failures received nothing more than a dismal whoosh. Though it cost twice as much as any other game, Sega's aptly titled Periscope was a major hit in Japan. In addition to providing cash flow, it turned out to be an undefined variable that allowed Rosen to flip the international business equation. Instead of importing games from America and selling them in Japan, Sega would now make their own games in Japan and export them to America. Periscope quickly became a major hit in the United States as well, generating so much demand that it became the first electronic game to dare to charge 25 cents per play. Sega followed up Periscope with a slew of similarly sophisticated games with equally uninspired titles such as Basketball, Drive Mobile, and Helicopter. With a reputation for quality, innovative technology, and a cross-continental distribution network, Sega became attractive to multinational corporations with an appetite for potential. In 1969, Rosen agreed to sell Sega to Gulf and Western on the condition that they kept him on as the company's CEO. Under his command, Sega continued to find steady revenues with a succession of electromechanical games like Soccer, Sea Devil, and Lunar Rescue, but jumped to new heights of influence with the creation, popularization, and global sensation of arcade video games. Following the success of Atari's Pong in 1973, Sega manufactured their own unabashedly similar arcade game, Pongtron. The game was a smash hit, prompting Sega to shift its focus to video games and, very nearly, do more than just copy Atari. In 1976, Rosen negotiated with Nolan Bushnell for Sega to acquire Atari, but on the day that they were to draft the contract, Bushnell backed out because he learned that his company had successfully developed a new console that could be more than one game through the innovation of cartridges. That became the Atari 2600 and led to untold riches, but Sega continued to thrive in its own right as well. Rosen Sega spent the decade mastering the art of video games, progressing from a Me Too mentality with games like Pongtron 2 and Fonz to an artistic devotion to the craft with games like Blockade and Monaco GP. As Sega's success grew, so did the constant problem of bootlegging, which led Rosen to cross paths with Nakayama. In Japan's highly stratified society, Hayao Nakayama aspired to rise to the top, But for someone with humble origins, an unremarkable family name, and a memorable rough-and-tumble personality, social elevation posed a major challenge. No matter where he went or what he did, it seemed that he'd always be walking around with the concrete blocks of his past tied around his ankles. But that didn't stop him from trying. If the past would not afford him access to certain banks, restaurants, or other places of status, the Nakayama's passport to the world would have to be his cunning resilience. He attended college to become a doctor, but wound up dropping out midway through the process. To find the next rung in his ladder to the extraordinary, Nakayama skimmed the newspaper's classified ads and pounced on the opportunity to become a salesman for a jukebox leasing company. As opposed to the fat cats upstairs who did little more than plan cushy vacations for themselves, Nakayama learned the amusement industry from inside the belly of the beast. With a preternatural talent for detecting failures, inefficiencies, and misgivings in others, he quickly discovered many ways that his company should change, and he particularly touted the need to get into the arcade business. His insights fell upon deaf ears. So, he left to start his own arcade distribution company, called Esco Trading. Nakayama lived vicariously through Esco Trading, which serviced and repaired arcade cabinets for companies like Sega. And with arcade fever sweeping the globe, life was good. But Nakayama wanted more than just good. He expanded Esco's operations, first to buying and selling used equipment and eventually to bootlegging American arcade games. Consequently, Esco became a threat to Sega, which prompted Rosen to ask for a meeting with the bandit who was cutting into his business. Rosen was not predisposed to like what he found. A street-smart, business-savvy guy with a gluttonous appetite for risk. But Rosen also believed that Nakayama had a marvelous sense of what machines the market would accept, which convinced him to make Nakayama an offer instead of threatening him. In 1979, Sega Enterprises purchased Esco Trading and made Nakayama the head of its Japanese operations. By joining forces, they could focus on keeping Sega ahead of the curve, while also thwarting an array of copycats who had recently cropped up, looking to make a quick buck in the arcade business with a horde of derivative games, companies like Irem, Nichibutsu, and Nintendo. By the early 1980s, Sega was generating revenue of over $200 million per year with hit games like Astro Blaster, Head-On, and Zaxxon. To outsiders impressed with Sega's success, it was easy to compartmentalize the credit and declare Nakayama the heart and Rosen the brains, the doer and the thinker, the yin and the yang. But the truth was that despite their very different personalities, they were kindred spirits, each with an unflinching hand on the Ouija board of success. Which made it all the more startling when Rosen retired in 1982, voicing concerns that the arcade business was headed for trouble. He turned over all control to Nakayama, then moved to California with his wife for their happily ever after. Nakayama continued to expertly steer the ship in Japan, but the video game crash of 1983 devastated the American business. With Sega reeling, Gulf and Western looked to unload the company. There were few suitors looking to get into the video game business while everyone else was getting out, but Rosen still believed in what he had started, and so he formed a buyer's group with Nakayama and Eseo Okawa, whose company, CSK, put up most of the $38 million they paid to buy back Sega. Under the new arrangement, Nakayama would run the majority of Sega's operations from Tokyo. Rosen would run the company's small American subsidiary from Beverly Hills. While Nakayama and Rosen were busy putting the pieces back together at Sega, their progress was dwarfed by Nintendo's success, which forever reconfigured the video game landscape. In a few short years, Nintendo found viability in the once barren handheld game market with its Game & Watch, conquered the arcade industry with Donkey Kong, and resurrected the home console business with the NES. What Nintendo managed to do in only a few short years made Sega's decades of success look like a child's artwork on the refrigerator of life. Kind of pretty, but also kind of pitiful. Not only had Nintendo single-handedly revived video games in the United States, but their utter domination transformed it from a niche industry into big business. There was a janitor's ring's worth of keys to Nintendo's success, but beyond the lucky alignment of people, places, and things, Their invasion of America appeared to be the critical element. Success abroad changed the perception of Nintendo from a trendy gizmo company into a cross-cultural powerhouse. In addition to worldwide clout, Nintendo's American pipeline tripled revenues, quadrupled the customer base, and immeasurably multiplied the reach of their soon-to-be iconic intellectual properties. Nakayama and Rosen couldn't turn a blind eye to such scorching success, forcing them to play a game of follow the new leader. In 1985, 2 years after Nintendo's Famicom launched in Japan, Sega released an 8-bit console of their own. In 1986, 1 year after Nintendo's U.S. invasion, Sega set their sights on also infiltrating the American market. In an attempt to replicate their competitors' staggering success, Rosen poached Nintendo's VP of sales, Bruce Lowry, to become Sega of America's first president. Lowry was handed the keys to the car, with Rosen supervising from the passenger seat as Sega of America's chairman and CEO. They zipped off to a fast start in June 1986, selling 125,000 units of Sega's Master System in the first 4 months. Even so, Sega could hardly compete with Nintendo, which had sold 2 million NES systems over the same period. In the coming months, Sega fell even further behind, and by 1987, Nintendo commanded 85% of the market. Unable to continue pouring money into a losing proposition, Sega threw in the red, white, and blue towel and chose to focus on coin-operated arcade games. They granted all of the marketing and distribution rights for their Master System to the toy manufacturer Tonka, who had no experience in the video game industry, and over the next 2 years did little to change that reputation. Part of this was due to the fool's errand it had become to compete against Nintendo, and the other part was due to Nakayama's aggressively marking up Sega's products to the point at which Tonka was left with almost no profit margin. 1 year after conceding the market to Nintendo, Sega returned to the party in a snazzy new outfit. Under the direction of Hideki Sato, the head of R&D, a team of engineers were successfully able to condense the technology inside Sega's arcade boards to fit into a sleek black box. Amazingly, Sega had created the world's first 16-bit console, but Nakayama and Rosen were torn on how to proceed. Should they jump back in the ring and try to knock out Nintendo, or play it safe and license the technology to another company? After their previous console debacle, they opted for the latter, leading Rosen to approach several prominent companies, but only one seemed foolish enough to think that they could actually beat Nintendo. Atari. He met with the head of their video game division, Michael Katz, who quickly became convinced that Sega's 16-bit system could be the key piece in Atari's resurgence to the top. Rosen and Katz excitedly prepared a presentation for Atari's president, Jack Trummell, who took one look at the thing and passed. Though Atari wouldn't be launching the 16-bit console, Michael Katz would. Rosen hired Katz to become Sega of America's second president and released this new console that Rosen had named Genesis, in the hopes that it truly would represent a new beginning for the company. As before, Rosen was content to supervise from the sidelines. But Nakayama wasn't particularly impressed with his hire. Katz may have been clever and experienced, but he didn't know how to manage people. He was too lax, too indecisive, and too predictable. He also shied away from office politics in the worst way possible. He nobly thought that he was above it. Worst of all, Katz was a video game journeyman at a time when Sega needed fresh blood. As head of the parent company, Nakayama could have nixed Katz at any time, but he didn't want to undermine Rosen, at least not directly. Instead of throwing Katz off the cliff, he decided to clip his wings and then see if he could still fly. If Katz wanted to internally develop a certain kind of game, then maybe he'd be told it wasn't Sega's forte. If he found an outside developer who could do the game he wanted, then maybe Japan would scoff at the cost, or chastise him for seeking outside help when Sega was perfectly capable of doing it themselves. Further adding to Katz's hornet nest was the reverse engineering situation with Electronic Arts. The night before the 1990 summer CES, Trip Hawkins had met with Rosen and Nakayama to let them know that EA had reverse-engineered the Genesis. Not only that, but EA had supposedly set aside $10 million to fight any potential litigation. Nakayama was furious, as was Rosen. but as the cooler-headed of the two, he was able to turn a potential shouting match into a more cordial negotiation that would last several months. This would eventually lead to a mutually beneficial arrangement, but for the time being, it was just another headache for Michael Katz. Rosen would try to support him, but even that became a double-edged sword. Because Katz was his guy, Rosen was less willing to allow him to take risks, like when Katz wanted to hire a new ad agency and Rosen nixed the idea because their current firm, Bozell, was located nearby in Los Angeles, and even if they weren't the best, their work was reliable. Through no fault of his own, Katz became embroiled in something of a philosophical chess game between Nakayama and Rosen. To keep tabs on Sega of America's new president, Nakayama relied on a tenacious young manager he had hired 1 month earlier, Shinobu Toyota, who up until this point had served as chief lieutenant to SOA's interim president, Dai Sakari. Coming from the aerospace division of the prestigious Japanese conglomerate Mitsubishi, Toyota knew nothing about video games but learned quickly from Sega's American president. Katz taught him what made for a good game, and more important, the value to Sega in offering a matrix of diverse titles, i.e. sports, puzzles, role-playing games. Toyota was thankful for the tutelage, but gratitude didn't prevent him from agreeing with Nakayama. 6 months into the job, Toyota strongly urged Nakayama to find a replacement for Katz, preferably someone who can more smoothly manage internal conflicts and external relations. Without notifying Rosen, Nakayama traveled to Hawaii and tracked down Kalinske. Throughout the courting process, Nakayama consistently asked Kalinske not to interact with Rosen. This seemed odd to Kalinske, until he better understood their bizarre relationship. Puppeteers who fought for control of their marionettes. Or at least that's how it appeared. Nevertheless, Kalinske took the job. Rosen appeared thrilled to have him on board, and now, less than 2 years later, Sega began cutting into Nintendo's lead. Nearly 40 years of drama, comedy, and innovation had led to this moment, with all of them in a ballroom in Las Vegas, celebrating past, present, and future. Once again, Kalinske waved at Sega's Masters of Destiny, who this time took notice and gestured for him to join them. After a sequence of smiles, handshakes, and pats on the back all around, Kalinske took a seat beside Rosen and Nakayama. He allowed himself a moment to imagine Nakayama diving under a table in slow motion, then forced himself to push the image out of his mind. "Pretty amazing, isn't it?" Kalinske said.
"I am certainly amazed," Rosen said, "but certainly not surprised."
"And this is only the beginning," Nakayama proclaimed.
"Well, now, let's not get ahead of ourselves," Rosen said. "I feel good about where we're headed, but for now we ought to just soak it all in."
"Yes, of course," Nakayama replied.
"All I'm saying is just that this is tiny compared to where we are going."
Rosen rolled his eyes, which prompted Nakayama to do the same. Kalinske wondered how many times this kind of exchange had occurred before. For a moment, none of them said anything, and they simply looked out onto the dance floor at what they had built together.
"All right now, that's enough,"
Rosen finally said to Kalinske, using a paternal tone that he rarely invoked.
"Don't waste another moment with us fossils. This is your moment. Go have some fun."
"Stop it," Kalinske said. "I could sit here for hours."
"Well, you'd be sitting alone then," Rosen said, standing. "Hiyo, you can stay if you want, but I'm going to retire to my room and see what's playing on the television."
"This is a good idea," Nakayama said, sporting a grin fit for a Bond villain. "I've got some other business to attend to."
They said their goodbyes and left Kalinske alone at the table, where he remained for some time. With a peaceful sigh, he gazed back out onto the dance floor to take in the wonderful sight of his employees letting loose. It was rare for him to see them and them not to see him. Usually, it was the reverse. Kalinske was used to being in the spotlight and liked it that way. But tonight was a monument to Sega's success, which couldn't have been accomplished without them. No matter how big or small their contributions, Every single one of them was a necessary part of the equation. "Pretty amazing, isn't it?" someone asked, snapping Kalinske out of his trance. It was Emil Heidkamp, senior vice president at Konami of America. Heidkamp was a kind-hearted, thoughtful salesman who had been with Konami since 1986, from the very first day they started making home video games. He'd been responsible for the launch and success of some of Nintendo's best-selling titles, like Castlevania, Contra, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Under Heidkamp's leadership, Konami had made Nintendo wealthy and vice versa. As a result, he'd grown close to Nintendo's top brass, fostering a relationship that he'd recently put on the line by agreeing to make games for Sega. "I am certainly amazed," Kalinske said, echoing Rosen's words from earlier. "But certainly not surprised." "Nor should you be," Heidkamp said, gently patting Kalinske on the shoulder. "You and your team do good work. I have nothing but respect for the guys in Redmond. But I'm glad that Sega managed to enter the picture while I was still here." "Still here? Why? Have plans to go somewhere?" Not at the moment, but I think that my time is coming to an end." "Emil, is everything okay?" Kalinske asked with sudden and genuine concern. "Oh, no, no, nothing dire," Heidkamp said, realizing how ominous he had sounded. "Did I never tell you about the deal I made with Mr. Kazuki?" he asked, referring to Takuya Kazuki, the president of Konami. Kalinske shook his head. "It was shortly after I joined Konami," Heidkamp said, squinting a little as he reached back for the details. "I found the Lord and became a born-again Christian. I said to Kazuki-san that there had to be a certain kind of purity to our games. I didn't want us going down the road of lowest common denominator with blood, nudity, and debauchery. After all, we're in the business of selling entertainment to kids. We have a certain responsibility, don't we?" Kalinske nodded, captivated. Heidkamp's story put words to a collection of tiny doubts that had been building up in the back of his mind. He hadn't been able to put his finger on the nature of these barnacles of dread until now. "What was the agreement?" "I made a deal with Mr. Kozuki that I would stick around and continue to take Konami to the top, as long as we never did anything worse than cartoon violence. He didn't hesitate for one second and agreed to the deal. Even more important, he backed up his words with actions. Right around that time, we had a game out of Japan called Dracula Satanic Castle, and he let me rename it Castlevania and make other slight modifications. I consider Mr. Kazuki a great friend, and I have no doubt that there is eternal truth to his words. But as I look around this industry that we're all creating, I can't help but realize it's only a matter of time." "It doesn't have to be," Kalinske said, shaking his head. He wasn't sure if he disagreed with Heidkamp's outlook, or if he just didn't want it to be true. "No, it doesn't have to be, but likely it will," Heidkamp said. "Have you seen what's coming into the arcades these days? The most popular game is Street Fighter, where the entire purpose is to clobber your opponent. I'll admit that, beyond the premise, the game itself is tame, but how long do you expect that to last? The world is full of slippery slopes, and once you start going down, well, there's only one way to go from there." "Right," Kalinske said vaguely, looking like he'd seen a ghost. "Oh, Tom, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to burden you with my personal woes," Heidkamp said, shaking his head. "All I meant to do was come over here and congratulate you on a job well done. Don't give another thought to this, okay?" Kalinske nodded, trying but failing to put it out of his mind. "Come on," Heidkamp said, standing. "Let's get back on the dance floor." "Sure thing," Kalinske said. "I'll meet you out there in a couple minutes." Heidkamp nodded and joined the swelling crowd on the dance floor. Kalinske watched from the table, trying to reconcile what he was seeing with what he had just heard. Had he been looking at this night all wrong? Was it not a celebration of passion, creativity, and hard work, but rather a villainous triumph of pulling the wool over the world's eyes? At least when he'd sold toys and faced similar claims of impropriety, There was always the fallback consolation that, in addition to entertainment, he was helping to activate a child's imagination. But that wasn't quite the case with video games, whose immediate feedback and pre-programmed outcomes could be seen as the opposite of imagination. Part of Kalinske wanted to laugh and discard such ridiculous thoughts, while another part wanted to dive under the table like Nakayama and hide from the world while he gave the nature of this business greater consideration. Back and forth the thoughts volleyed, playing out the struggle between heart and brain. Eventually, Kalinske shook off the dueling thoughts and let the music woo him back to happiness. Big Bang Beat was playing a fast-paced version of Celebrate, which reminded Kalinske that tonight he cannot be a man divided, nor could he be one tomorrow or any day after that. He owed it to himself to make the most of this wonderful opportunity. He owed it to Nakayama, who had picked him to be his guy. And he owed it to all the people here tonight, people who meant a great deal to him, who worked harder every day, and who deserved everything they'd ever dreamed for themselves. Kalinske refused to let a petty case of conscience jeopardize everything that lay ahead. First, they would need to pull even with Nintendo, and next, they would take the lead. He didn't know what would happen after that, but he vowed that it would be beautiful and extraordinary. Kalinske got up from the table and joined the bouncy, happy people on the dance floor. Tonight, Sega had arrived, but as Nakayama had just said, it really, truly was only just the beginning. Part 3. The Next Level. Chapter 22. Target Practice. "It's not arrogance," Peter Main explained to a room full of skeptical faces. When he delivered these words, he truly believed them with all his heart. The owners of those skeptical faces, however, felt fairly certain that Main's heart was made of stone. It was December 1991, 3 weeks before Winter CES, and he and Randy Peretzman were in Minneapolis for an emergency meeting. 1 week earlier, they had met with Target's buying group to discuss Nintendo's new returns policy, and management was subsequently so incredulous that they were invited back for an encore performance, this time with the senior VP, EVP, and president. "Arrogance? Not even close, fellas. It's just good business sense, that's what it is." "It's the truth," Peretzman added with a friendly nod. "If you would like, we're more than happy to send you a copy of the numbers." It took a moment for Target's managers to fully absorb the news, and when they did, they were not particularly moved. "This is not about numbers," the senior VP explained. "It's about relationships. Our relationship with our guests and our relationship with Nintendo." "We understand, and we respect your point of view," Main conceded, torching his words with a light touch. "But we need you to understand where we're coming from as well. If this keeps happening, then it's only a matter of time before we go bust." "Oh, come on," someone scoffed, outraged by the notion that Nintendo's empire could crumble so easily. "It's a minor problem at best." In the silence that followed, Main and Peretzman locked eyes in a moment of shared commiseration. They had not expected this to be an easy task, but anticipating the pushback didn't make enduring it any more enjoyable. "With all due respect, fellas, this is a major problem, and our new policy is the only conceivable way to fix this thing." Whether minor or major, the problem itself was relatively easy to understand. Shortly after the Super Nintendo was released, customers began returning 8-bit NES consoles to their nearest retailer, and then using this refund to buy the 16-bit system. From Nintendo's perspective, this was understandable, but only up to a certain point. If someone had bought an NES in August, and then a month later when the SNES was released, they wanted to return it for the newer model, that was fine. Nintendo didn't ever want their customers to feel cheated. But by the same token, they didn't want to feel cheated themselves. And that's exactly how they felt when customers began returning NES systems they had played for years, some originally purchased as far back as 1985. In effect, They were flipping the old consoles into the new ones for nothing more than a small fee to cover the price difference. The reason they could do this was because of the extremely liberal return policies that most retailers had in place. In 1991, someone could walk into a store with no receipt and no original packaging. They didn't even have to have all the parts. I don't remember this NES coming with the controller. And receive a full refund by claiming there was a defect. No proof had to be provided, nor did the retailers even really care. In their eyes, the customer was always right, and financially it didn't hurt them much because they would just send the supposedly defective product back to the manufacturer for their own refund. As a result of retailers empowering their customers with the gift of infinite rightness, companies like Nintendo would suffer the costs of that moral wrongness. Perhaps Nintendo would have felt more sympathetic about the situation if their products had been considered notoriously defective, but that was not the case, not even close. Because of Yamauchi's fixation on controlling every tiny detail, and Arakawa's unyielding dedication to the user experience, Nintendo enjoyed a famously low defect rate, less than 1%. In addition, NOA was one of the first companies to devote an entire department to studying, analyzing, and managing the returns process. Given this unrelenting commitment to excellence, was it so much to ask that the retailers getting rich off Nintendo stop turning a blind eye to the abuses of that process? Peter Main shook his head. Just ask yourselves where this'll end. Let's say that we continue the way we've been going. Then what happens 5 years from now when we release a 32-bit system? And then 5 years after that when we come out with a new 64-bit machine, and so on and so forth? Are you honestly going to let these people keep turning in something they bought in 1987 for the rest of their lives? Well, someone said after a collective shrug, what's the alternative? I just told you the alternative, Main declared. Our 90-day return policy. I think that you will agree that 3 months is more than enough time to figure out if something is defective. Is that really too much to ask of your customers? Guests, Target Senior VP said, forcefully pronouncing the word. Huh? Main said, mentally replaying his previous sentence. Which guests? You said customers, but at Target we don't think of our visitors that way. We consider them guests, and we treat them as such. All right, Main said, making every effort not to roll his eyes. Your guests will be given 90 days, which certainly seems like a fair amount of time. Come on, guys. That's 3 whole months, Parrotsman said. Wars have been won and lost in much shorter amounts of time. Regardless, someone else said, how would we even enforce such a thing? Finally, thought Main, a good question. This was another aspect where Nintendo demonstrated that they were logical innovators, not unreasonable dictators. To create a clearer picture of a product's life cycle, Nintendo had conceived, developed, and patented a system called POS Electronic Registration. This system allowed retailers to track a product from manufacture all the way until purchase, and also offered other features like real-time sales reports and trend analysis. For Nintendo, this methodology had been invaluable for managing inventory, and they hoped that retailers would find it similarly useful. Ideally, they would even use it for non-Nintendo consumer products as well. The system, Main said after describing it, is all about efficiency. But, as with all of our advances, it's about more than just Nintendo. Gentlemen, Target Senior VP stated, I think you're missing the point. Once again, Main and Parrotsman briefly locked eyes, this time with a mutual curiosity about how this could possibly be the case. With all due respect, Parrotsman said, what is it that you think we're missing here? The senior VP squinted for a moment, evidently looking for the most delicate way to express himself. The returns issue may be a big problem, but forgive me for saying that it merely feels like today's big problem. First it was the allocations. Believe me, I get it. There's only so much product to go around. There's a chip shortage in Asia. There's no way we can give you everything you want because that's what Atari did and look what happened there. Next, it was getting rid of December 10th billing, which, once again, I get. You sell us something, you expect us to pay for it right away. That makes sense. So does North Bend, to a certain extent. North Bend referred to Nintendo's newly opened distribution center in North Bend, Washington, which was the latest disruptive innovation from Minoru Arakawa. In a pattern that could be traced back to his engineering roots, Arakawa was forever seeking ways to improve efficiency. As physical proof of this obsession, he carried around a thick tan ultra suede portfolio that was always overflowing with cost sheets, inventory reports, and all sorts of additional data that would put most company presidents to sleep. But Arakawa relished the details. He loved knowing exactly how many cents it cost to purchase the little screws that held the game cartridges together, and he loved even more looking for places to buy them more cheaply, finding a route that shipped them faster, or any other way to improve productivity. Most of the time, Arakawa's attention to detail manifested itself in small ways, like a better deal on packaging. But occasionally it would result in an industry-wide shakeup, as it had with the new $60 million distribution center in North Bend. From the moment game cartridges came into this 360,000-square-foot distribution center until the moment they were loaded out for delivery, the merchandise was touched only twice by human hands. Instead, the majority of the work was done by highly sophisticated robots, unmanned forklifts, and an enormous mainframe computer, which were collectively responsible for getting the products out to retailers as soon as inhumanly possible. North Bend operated with a futuristic level of efficiency, but a part of that efficiency required that retailers had to use Nintendo's distribution center instead of their own. So instead of the retailer receiving their order at a central warehouse and then parceling it out to their stores as they saw fit, Nintendo now wanted to be the one doing the parceling. Nintendo would, of course, follow the retailer's instructions about which products go where, and they would do so with incredible efficiency. But from the retailer's perspective, there was more at play here. Efficiency was a good thing, but what was most efficient for Nintendo was not necessarily what was most efficient for the retailer. Maybe the retailer wanted to hold off on selling a certain game. Maybe they didn't want to provide such great transparency into their operations. Or maybe they just didn't want to pay Nintendo for a service that they already provided, even if perhaps they didn't provide it as well. Whatever the case, retailers didn't have much of a choice. As with most of Nintendo's policies, it was Nintendo's way or no way at all. And the fact that they didn't have a choice often bothered the retailers more than the actual situation itself. The retailers believed this was just another example of Nintendo's arrogance. Meanwhile, Peter Main and Randy Peretzman believed this was just another example of Nintendo's innovation being misconstrued as arrogance. And though neither side would ever admit it, in a way, they were both absolutely correct. "The point is," Target Senior VP continued, "I can appreciate the intentions behind everything that Nintendo does, and as a result, we've always found a way to comply with, shall we say, your pioneer spirit. Sometimes doing so has cost us money, sometimes it cost us manpower, and other times it cost us the flexibility to run our company in the manner we desire. But these are all costs that we are willing to accept. What we are not willing to accept, however, is now putting the cost on our valued guests. And this latest, it just goes too far." "But your Main began, this time catching himself. "Your guests are abusing the relationship. You have to factor this in to some degree." "What's to factor in? This is just the way things are done. Look at Nordstrom. They will take back shoes for up to 10 years. "Yeah?" Main shot back. "Well, we're called Nintendo, not Nordstrom." The senior VP let out a sigh. "Ah, Peter, Randy," he said, "we are not trying to be difficult, but please just understand that this policy really violates the whole tenet of how we view our guests. It's all about trust, and no matter what, We cannot violate that trust and interfere with the rights of our guests to return anything they've ever bought from us. Maine nodded, scouring his mind for any last shred of common ground. I hear you, he said. And it is not our intention to interfere with what you've got going.